get here. This is Thursday, April 10th. This is the meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules. On the agenda today, we have a work session for the purpose of considering major drafting requests, hearings on two measures, and a hearing and work session on a third measure. SJR 31, which was posted earlier, will not be heard today. We'll start with a public hearing and work session on SCR 5, public hearing and work session.
Madam Co-Chair, SCR 5 honors former Representative Denny Jones.
Mr. Bronner, would you like to come up with me, please?
Can you ask questions about SCR 31 as long as I can for that one?
Senator Bile, I'll speak to you later. Thank you, members of the committee, the two members of the committee.
We are strategically seated far from each other just to keep you moving.
I see. Okay, good afternoon. I'm State Senator Bev Clarno from District 27. It is a privilege to testify in support of honoring Denny Jones, a remarkable man whose services to Oregon are numerous. In my 8 years serving in the Oregon House of Representatives, I quickly learned the great esteem in which Denny Jones was held by all. His guidance and advice was invaluable. In 1972, he was elected to the Oregon House of Representatives and served with distinction until 1999, including service on the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, the Emergency Board, the Committees for Agriculture, Transportation, and Education. Denny Jones is known and admired as a man of few words. In 1995, it was my pleasure as Speaker to have Denny Jones serve as a co-chair of Ways and Means. He did his utmost to protect Oregonians' hard-earned dollars. A personal friend and well-known to many, I would like to recognize Denny Jones for his integrity, his experience, knowledge, and formidable work ethic. Thank you. With me is Frank Bronner, and I'll let him say what he thinks about Denny.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Frank Bronner, retired. I appreciate this opportunity to make a couple comments about Denny Jones. Joanne and I, my wife and I, grew up in Ontario, and so we've had the pleasure of knowing Denny and Mildred when she was alive, maybe longer than some of you. There are so many instances and experiences that I share with Denny, but let me just tell you a couple. Denny bothers me when he plays pitch because he normally beats me. If you have looked at the pitch tournament at this present time in this building...
You are going to bring this up, huh?
I am going to bring this up.
Thank you very much.
You lost too, huh?
I lost to him, yes.
And so did I.
Well, I had a lousy partner.
My wife, Joanne, and Denny Jones beat us...
He's a very distinguished gray-headed gentleman that's not on the Supreme Court.
Anyway, my wife and Denny are in the winner's bracket, and we're defeated, and others have fallen as well. Denny loves Oregon more than anybody I know. I was with Denny in the Baker Interpretive Center one day when I couldn't find him. He was gone. And I looked over there, and there was a crowd. Denny is explaining how this plow worked when the pioneers used it, and he had an audience. I said, Denny, from now on, let's charge admission. Denny also kept some pretty tight purse strings, as you know, in this building. Denny had his envelope that had all the numbers on it, and he could cite them to you. One time, Joanne and I and Mildred and Denny traveled, and we came to the town of Denial, Oregon. And I don't know if you've ever been there, but there's not much there. There is a motel with 5 rooms. Denny wanted us to stay in Denial because they had an excellent breakfast the next morning. We stayed in Denial. He had 2 rooms. One was a $12 room, and one was a $14 room, and he asked me which room Joanne and I wanted to stay in. This wasn't that long ago. We stayed in the $14 room because Denny really had a hankering to stay in the $12 room because there was $2 difference. And I won't describe the room that we had for $14, but I was anxious for breakfast to come, and then come to find out the breakfast didn't serve breakfast on Tuesday mornings. Denny and I have traveled a great deal of this state together, and I will tell you there's no place in Oregon that he loves any less. He appreciates this state. But when you travel with him in eastern Oregon from ranch to ranch to ranch, as I've done, you recognize that this is somebody that's contributed so much to so many. I urge the adoption of the concurrent resolution.
And I would just say in closing that if I might close for both of us, I think so often we wait until it's too late to tell someone thanks, and I'd like to do this now since Denny is 92 years old. Thank you.
Any questions or comments?
Well, I got to tell you, I'd have a really hard time supporting this because Denny Jones, for two sessions, would steal my glasses off my desk in the house continually. And the last time he did it, he rubber banded them to my microphone, and I couldn't find him for 2 days. You know? And, I mean, he's a cattle thief. He's a horse wrestler. You know, he has no character. Who could give him a character reference? I sent him a letter. They asked me to send a letter when they were having a roast over there, and I called him everything but a child of God.
We are in work session. Is there a motion?
Madam Chair, I would
Senator
move.
Atkinson.
Mrs. Chair, I would SCR 5 for the due pass recommendation.
Senator Atkinson moves SCR 5 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Chair, there's an amendment that I failed to mention.
Oh, yes, I knew there was an amendment as well. Senator Atkinson?
I pull back my motion and move the Dash 1 amendment to SCR 5.
Staff, would you share with us the Dash 1 amendment?
The Dash 1 amendment changes the last name of Mildred Jones to her
name
at the time she was married, which is Altno.
Senator Atkinson moves the Dash 1 amendments to SCR 5. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so moved.
Madam Chair.
Senator Atkinson.
I would move the concurrent resolution as amended to the floor with a due adopt recommendation.
Senator Atkinson moves SCR 5 as amended to the floor with a due adopt recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so moved. And I would like to carry that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Atkinson.
Mr. Bronner was discussing that hotel in denial.
Yes.
It might interest you to know that a friend of mine bought that hotel and has redone the rooms. I think they're $33 and $34 a night now.
They're
and
oh, man.
The rooms are actually in Nevada, out on the line.
Really?
Probably pay less property taxes there.
That brings us a question you probably shouldn't ask here.
Senator Beyer, you're just having a terrible time behaving yourself today, aren't you? Okay.
Property value.
Let's see. We need to do next. SCR. Better do that right now. Yes. I'll open a measure drafting an introduction request for committee approval.
Members, you each have a memo describing four items that that have been requested for your approval today. One is the drafting, and then you have the drafting one is on the federal tax code for veterans who have served their country after 1976. Then you have LC 3563, LC 1613, 1673, and LC 3546. The three legislative drafts you have previously approved.
Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move LC 1673, 3546, 3563 to be introduced as bills.
Yes, and do you want to address the drafting request as well?
I was waiting
okay.
for Mr. Timmery to...
Yeah, there's the drafting request.
He did.
Also number four, the drafting request.
Senator Beyer moves LC 1673, LC 3546, LC 3563, and moves to approve the drafting request. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, some... We'll now open a work session, public hearing on SJR 33. Staff?
I can come up with something worse than that for you. I mean, you went on for, what, 20 minutes?
SJR 33, upon approval by voters of the November 2004 general election, amends the Oregon Constitution to allow laws to define nudity and sexual activity and laws to prohibit persons younger than 21 from viewing nudity and sexual activity.
This is the if you get married before start 21, you can be very bored. We had several other names for this bill. Senator Carno won an award. She won an honorable mention. I'm just talking about awards for bills.
Thanks. We'll discuss that at a later time. Thank you very much. Senator Starr, would you like to come up? Did you already discuss this bill? Yes.
I described it.
Do you have anyone else you want to have come up and testify with you?
I think there are several that will testify.
Oh, okay. I have a lot of names here.
I'll just kick it off and then let the folks testify. For the record, I'm Senator Bruce Starr. I represent Senate District 15, parts of Western Washington County. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss Senate SJR 33, Senate Joint Resolution 33, with you. All of you have served in this legislature long enough to have dealt with issues that Senate Joint Resolution 33 deals with, and that's the regulation of adult business. And this is my turn. I know many of us have had adult businesses that have located in their district and have experienced constituents that were upset because of the location of these adult businesses, whether they're next to schools, next to churches, access for minors, those kinds of things. It's not the first time that this legislature or a legislature has attempted to grapple with this very difficult issue, and this is, I guess, our next attempt. Clearly, this bill would... as it is drafted, would provide the legislature an opportunity to regulate adult businesses as it relates to limiting and prohibiting a person under the age of 21 from participating in what's going on in these adult businesses. Quite frankly, as the bill is drafted, it's likely overbroad and would need to be narrowed somewhat. And I would hope that... if there's an inclination on this committee to work this issue again, as we've worked it in the past, that we can work together to narrow that, to get to the focus of the issue. I just appreciate really the opportunity for the committee to spend some time listening to the public testimony. There are several constituents from Washington County that have come down to Salem today to share with you kind of their experience, some of the research that's been done. Again, research that a lot of us has probably already heard in previous testimony on issues that surround adult businesses, but the impact on communities, the impact on people's lives, the impact on women who are... work in these establishments, the folks that go to these establishments, and especially the impacts on young people. And these, we're talking about people that are 18 to 8, from 18 to 21, and what kinds of things can occur, and the kinds of addictions and other things that can occur in that younger population. I know it's somewhat difficult. In that we recognize 18-year-olds as adult in some respects, obviously not as it relates to the consumption of alcohol, And this would kind of, I think, tie this consumption of alcohol with the participation in either viewing or watching, going to these adult establishments. And that's where I think the definition needs to be narrowed, because if you use it, the language that it is in the resolution now, you probably would loop in, you know, locker rooms and you know, families that are together in hotel rooms or whatever, and that's not the goal here. With that, I think I will turn the microphones over to the folks that have come to testify. And again, I appreciate the opportunity for the hearing. What I'd like to do is kind of have conversations with each of the members of the committee to kind of get a judge of what kind of interest there is in working this issue. I'd like to, if possible, narrow the language here to make it work better, and hopefully we can again try to deal with this very difficult issue. I think that has impacted Oregonians from east to west, from NISA in eastern Oregon to Medford in southern Oregon to folks in southwest Portland. Now it's in what I would call my sleepy community of Aloha. It's not really sleepy, but it's, you know, it's an unincorporated part of Washington County. We've got an establishment that's within short distances of schools and churches and has had an impact in the lives of my constituents. So appreciate the opportunity for the hearing and the willingness to listen this afternoon.
Thank you, Senator Starr. And you mentioned that there possibly would be amendments. Would you be willing to coordinate a group if there were people who...
Absolutely. And I'd like to, again, communicate with the committee members probably one-on-one to see what kind of response there will be to, again, tackling this difficult issue. So thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Brent Borchers?
Should we ask them handouts? How should we handle
that? To Pam.
Did you tell the nice judge I would get this job from?
Okay, I have an answer.
Excuse the ignorance in the protocols, the first attempt, but is that what we do, to sit down?
No, you sit down, please. Have a chair and identify yourself for the record, and then if you have testimony you're handing out, you don't need to read that word for word. We just rather, if you are willing, to just tell us what you want
sure.
us to know.
Okay.
And then we ask if there's any questions and discussions.
Okay. For the record, my name is Brent Borchers. I'm a resident of Portland. I was a resident of Hillsboro not long ago. I am involved in this organization that is seeking to rid our community of this awful influence. I became involved in this group. We do regularly go down, picket this establishment. But I guess the interesting thing is the conversations that we have with the people that go down there, both the ones that are against it and the ones who see no wrong in it. And so we came up, we worked with Bruce Starr's office, we came up with this SJR 33 to limit the age of 21. And let me just point out what our objectives in this are. There are actually three. It will not solve the problem, but it will, for reasons similar to the alcohol restriction, it will give three more years to our young people to mature before they are subjected to the corrupting influences of this type of entertainment. A second issue is we have 18, 19, in some cases 20-year-old young people going to high school and working in these places or just coming as patrons. They go back to school. They come at their noon hour on occasion. They go back to school, and they're talking to their friends, saying how neat and cool it was. And a third case, a third situation, we're trying to help contain the costs, and there's plenty of information available to the cost to government. In allowing this type of industry to flourish amongst us. Just a few highlights. I'm not going to get too much into there. I kind of broke this down into five points which we'll address. It does require a constitutional amendment. There's lots of discussion we could put on there, but again, I just emphasize this will not correct the problem, but it will lead us down the road a little bit further to helping. There are social and personal problems engendered by the assault on the young, and it's coming from every direction in society. I don't have to talk about that. You're all aware of it. But there is no conceivable direction in society from which our young are not being accosted with this awful deluge. Third point is adult entertainment and associated deviations will prove to be the greatest single destructive influence in our society. History proves it, and again, more information will be provided there. And finally, is the fifth point, financial cost to Oregon taxpayers and society in general are growing in staggering amounts. I guess just before I get into all the details, you can read the details. And what I just tell you a personal story. I was involved 20 years ago where I was called to be a leader of a group of people in a church-type environment. And, again, I was new at that situation, too. And I went in and dutifully tried to assign the best people. We had 120 positions in this organization that we had to put people in charge of. And I dutifully attempted to put the best people in the adult organizations. We had for the men, for the women, for the collective groups. We kept having problems. And I couldn't figure out why we're having these. It just didn't flow right. And in counseling with my counselors, we decided one day that we were going to change our tactics and put the best people in with the youth. Start with the primary age and work our ways up through the young adult organizations. Within a month, everything was flowing. And I think society clearly points out, you read the papers every day, that it is not flowing correctly. And it's because of the attack on our youth. We can correct our youth. We can correct the problem down the road. Something has to be done. And too many people say nothing. They just ignore it, thinking it's not their problem. We are a group, a collective group of citizens that have organized. We're just trying to say something and get people's attention. This has to be addressed in some way. This is the first real legal attempt that we've made to address this problem. Statistics are just everywhere, and so many things. I'll point out one thing here. Incidentally, we had the testimony of a man, David Sherman, who was involved as a manager of these establishments back in Ohio area. And I have a testimony from him where he points out very clearly that there's every illegal activity going on in this industry. They hide it. This particular place that we're involved with, of course, is a model citizen right now because we're there, people are watching, they're paying attention. They don't like us there, even though they say it's contrary. But anyway, just 3 days ago, I don't know, when I'm out of time you can tell me, but in the financial costs, 3 days ago it was published that 2.1 million people are now incarcerated in jails in this country. It doesn't even address the juvenile population. It is more than ever before. And then this is what's interesting. In 1990, compared to the previous two decades, the United States saw the highest juvenile arrest rate for violent crimes ever. Teen arrests for forcible rape had doubled. Teen murder rates quadrupled. During those same two decades, the suicide rate for teenagers tripled. And on it goes. Maybe I should stop there. But.
Well, we have several pages of people to testify, and I didn't mean to be disruptive to you. I'm trying to figure out.
No, that's fine. I know I've said enough.
One of the things we have is a kind of a policy here that if you live more than 100 miles, we need to let those people go. And I understand you're the sponsor of the bill, and I'm sorry to be disruptive to you. So
no, that's okay. I expected only 5 minutes, and I think I've used that.
Sometimes we get confused here and have to work with our staff to figure out where we're going. So I appreciate your patience.
Sure.
Hang on a second. Let me see if there's any questions. Any questions? Excellent testimony. And I did glance through this. I have it in the file, and we'll be able to look through
it. A lot of references there for you to look at.
Thank you very much. I think what we'll do is... we have a lot of other people that would like to testify on this bill. And what I'm going to do is have the gentleman come up that's done the that is from more than 100 miles. I recognize the prefix as Bend. Thomas Eichhorst, if I pronounced your name wrong. And then we'll close this hearing temporarily until we can get to JR 22 and deal with that issue, and then we'll come back to this one.
I'm going to read the whole testimony, if that's okay. It's only 2 pages long.
Pardon me?
It's only 2 pages long. I'm
and
good.
If you'll say your name correctly, since I've...
My name is Tom Eichhorst, and I'm from the city of Bend. Okay. To this esteemed body, my name is, for the record, is Thomas A. Eichhorst, and I'm a resident of the city of Bend in the great state of Oregon. My hopes this day is that what I am about to say will help you in your decision to pass this piece of legislation and to help the many individuals suffering from either direct or indirect involvement dealing with the sex industry and its effects on our daily lives. The time has come to make firm and lasting change upon an issue that affects our civilized society in such a way as to bring self-destruction, lest we are present this day make a decided and determined difference. We're considering and are deeply in favor of a piece of legislation that would in effect prevent to a more equitable degree and in a constitutional format the many forms of pornographic material as well as misrepresentation of the human body from being displayed before the eyes and minds of the youth of society as to corrupt their mental processes and to stop wherein if possible under the age of individuals under age 21 individuals from being taken advantage of by an industry that should never have been. My fellow Oregonians, this is as much a war of terrorism as it relates to an industry that has little if any regard for human dignity and then thrives solely upon the lust and greed at a heavy expense of others and our relationships to one another. The pornography industry involves every aspect of society from clothing industry, motion picture, illegal drug use, alcohol, prostitution, sexual crimes, sexual disease, mental illness, advertising, increase for the need of more policing activities, and time is spent in fighting cases in court. If ever there was an industry that all was guilty of, that ever was guilty of, was of malpractice, it would in reality be the sex industry in how it indirectly destroys lives and really ruins a civilized society. Again, to this highly esteemed body here at Oregon State Capitol, I personally appeal to you in your wisdom and understanding to really consider what is really said here today as you make your decision. I'm here also to give my own personal testimony as to how this, the sex industry, has directly affected my own life and to what point it has driven me in my connection with it. I do this of my own volition in order to help others suffering from this intense, dysfunctional lifestyle. I started my life with pornography at the age of 18 by first using the mildest forms of pornography and then as time went on, not being satisfied with that, moved on to ever deeper into the darker realms of pornography. To the point that it formed within my own being an intense guilt and eventually self-hatred. Because of my inability to simply walk away from something that I thought I could control, but in reality was really controlling me. I also used pornography as a means of escaping my own inability to deal with life in general, much in the same way as people that use either illegal drugs or alcohol. But the pornography also fed my sexual fantasies in such a way as they became morbid, especially as I wanted someone to do me harm with those experiences as well. Everyone must keep in mind that this problem with pornography and the sex industry too, I want to emphasize, has no limits and takes with it no hostages, and eventually it can, if allowed, destroy an individual entirely. The stimuli also help aid in my deepening depression and eventually suicidal attempts, to the point that I ended up several times in the hospital for attempting my own life just to end what I... because I wanted much to be free of sexual problems, and I thought that death would be much better than living a life in hell, Your Honor. I am now getting help and problems with my recovery, but my concern is for the many that still suffer and that cannot escape the deadly clutches of pornography. But let me make this plainly clear. The society does not make it at all that easy to change one's own thinking and deeply ingrained thoughts, but instead encourages it to either a larger or lesser degree. And that unless society sees what is really occurring and makes the necessary change in order to really protect itself, then nothing will ever happen except to say that the problem will just get ever increasingly worse and eventually society will destroy itself. And not too different from many of other civilizations in the past. In finalizing, and for the record, I would like to state also that the pornography industry will tell us that the product and its very existence is a protected... It's a protected form of expression under the Free Speech Clause of the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. when in reality this is nothing but an interpretation of the free speech clause and not the actual clause where it really states or says. And therefore, the pornographic industry's logic from its very beginning is flawed. As we here must keep in mind that where all forms of speech are indeed expression, that at the same time not all forms of expression are considered speech. If this were the case, that anything done, whether legally or illegally, could be protected, and again, freedom of speech, by simply using the same said logic of using it or interpreting it to include expression. I want to thank you for this time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Thomas. Any discussion or questions? Appreciate you coming over from Central Oregon, and that's home for me, and I miss it. I imagine it was sunny there today.
No, it's rainy, actually.
Oh, don't tell anybody that.
At least
thank
it's not snowing.
Much. I'll close the public hearing on SJR 33 and open a public hearing on SJR 22.
SJR 22 is Senator Dickert's. Is the sponsor, upon approval by voters at the November 2004 general election, amends the Oregon Constitution to establish a five-member commission to do congressional and legislative redistricting. You have dash one amendments from Senator Dickert that do several things. Among them, remove the commission responsibility for congressional redistricting.
Good afternoon, Senator Dickert. Would you like to go ahead and address your, or put your name on the record since we all know you? You should have it on there for everybody else.
Madam Chair, my name is Ryan Dickert, 8375 Southwest Monica Court, Portland, Oregon, 97223. This bill, Madam Chair, the idea behind it was watching the last redistricting process that we just went through. I thought that there might be a better way to do it, and in conversations with former Secretary of State Clay Myers, found that many, many other states redistrict in a way that was different than the way Oregon did it. I think our process is set up to be, by structure, a more of a partisan process. By putting it in the legislature's hands. What I found was, in the attached handouts that you have, is that many, many, many states have chosen a very different path that I think works very, very effectively. We modeled this bill after Washington. The proposal is pretty straightforward. Each leader of both chambers, the House and the Senate, would each appoint one person. So, Madam Chair, you would be appointing one person if this was the year 2010. Senator Brown would, Senator Kefauri would, and Representative Knope would. Those four would then have a set period of time to pick a fifth that is not from a major political party, so they would be a non-affiliated fifth person. That, just by nature, and hopefully those four would be picked. Obviously, they're going to represent the viewpoint of the political party, but I think that also the hope would be that they also, and what we're finding in these other states, it has worked very, very effectively, is there are folks with a pretty broad viewpoint in terms of the state and our role in the state and a productive process. Those five then draft the redistricting for congressional and for the legislature. It's been done, I think, very, very effectively, what I've found in these other states. And just looking back into Oregon's history on this, never once have we successfully, the legislature, redistricted it ourselves. It has always been punted because we could never achieve that goal ourselves. If those five, the one backstop that we put in there, which you have to do as you give it to the Supreme Court, if those five can't agree, but what we have found also in other states is those five usually can, because of the timelines and the guidance that the legislature provides and the voters of the state would have to provide with this. They provide the guidance to achieve it. So I think this is a very needed, very important, and I think it would only have to happen this session, because I think this is the one session that we could do it as we get closer to the year 2010. I think this the opportunity to put something like this out there is diminished. So I welcome the opportunity to come here. I think this is a really important measure, and in a way that we could signal, which I think we've done actually in the state Senate this session in a 15-15 Senate, that we're very interested in a less partisan, more policy-focused process, and I think this would be a huge step forward out of the state Senate to really indicate our commitment to this.
Thank you, Senator.
I don't know how to interpret that.
I wouldn't venture that you try.
Thank you, Madam
I'm
Chair.
I'm just sitting here thinking, let's see, we could get somebody from the Green Party, or we could get somebody from the Constitutional Party. That would be really helpful. I have a district that goes from the University of Oregon from Franklin Boulevard down to 10 miles north of Crater Lake. Community of interest, baby.
Thank you, Senator Deckard. Any other questions or discussion?
Madam Chair, I guess Senator Deckard and I have talked about this, and as frightening as it may seem, I think we're in agreement here, or at least in concept. I haven't had a chance to look at the specifics yet, but I like it. Let's move it. Let's get it done.
My goodness, Senator Deckard, that is amazing.
Madam Chair.
Senator Burdick, I'm so like shocked I can't even
talk. I would like to know why you and Senator Beyer consider that so shocking.
What's that? I'm the one that considers it shocking.
No, he said, I heard him say on the record of the Senate Rules Committee that it was shocking.
Okay.
No, because he was shocked when I said I liked it.
I was pleasantly surprised. Madam Chair, Senator Corcoran's explanation is exactly my point, though, is that by picking a fifth, and it's in other states what they've done with these commissions is it's been an easy fifth. It's someone that's a non-affiliated independent that is your best judge, and then that person really is required. But I think the pressure on those four is really to go out and search the state for who is that fifth that could really be a fair judge, because that person's going to be called upon to be the judge. In every other instance that you have before you on the attached handout, and I think that is a process, and I'd only ask you to compare that to the structure that we have in place now, and what is the better of the two processes, and even if you can, and it's hard for us to remove ourselves, but if we can, and just really look at this objectively, what is the better process for a state to really draw its political boundaries, both congressional and legislative? I would also say, Madam Chair, that I'm very open to, if conceptually this committee's committed, and I've talked to a few of the members who have all seemed supportive of the notion, if conceptually this committee is very interested in this idea, I'd like to work with one or two to, if there is any fine-tuning that is needed. One big question is, do you include congressional or do you take them out and you only deal with legislative? That would make it certainly more straightforward and simple. But I would ask for.
I think Senator Deckard, that Senator Beyer has indicated an interest in working with you with this, and I think we all would like to see our system improved, and that there's room for improvement. I'm just wondering how four people pick one person when you have, as Senator Corcoran, not only is his district very diverse, but many districts in the state are, but I'm sure they would be able to do that. And before I forget, and speaking with Clay Myers last week, he said to tell you hello.
Oh, okay.
Any further discussion, Senator Corcoran?
I don't see anything wrong with diversity in a district. And, you know, that was a decision made in a very political venue. How many states have, I mean, do you think that selecting this fifth person is gives you some sort of objectivity?
Madam Chair, what I have found, and we just did, and I would encourage you, and I will share what we found just researching this, is the states we talked to, Arizona, Washington, and obviously we have a great study for this because every state just went through their redistricting process. If you look at the ones that I found congressionally, legislative, across the board, the ones in Washington and Arizona, and this is both political parties, seem to feel pretty good about the redistricting process that was undertaken. And the comments that I certainly got, and this was Republican and Democrat, were that it was more of a scientifically, and this is not just Oregon, it's any state that has the traditional structure, where it's launched into a political debate, which if that's the route we choose, that would be the route we choose. But I think a more scientific basis for it is not a bad way to go, and I think that's why you're finding more and more states going this route of putting together a commission and having that commission at least taking it out of the direct hands of the legislature and putting it in some commission to really draw the maps. You always have that the Supreme Court is your final backstop, but what they have found is the commission actually works. doing the four with the fifth as the judge, that the pressure is on those commission members to really go out and find and debate, and I'm sure they haggle, that fifth that could be the independent voice and judge that really helps get to construct the process.
Thank you, Senator Deckert. Thank you very much.
Next thing you know, we're not going to have a partisan legislature.
We heard a bill about that as well.
Yeah, I know. Brian Johnson
July.
Had a bill like that in 95. That was the one when Markham said, well, we shoot this dog in front of him or wait till he leaves the room.
Oh, I remember that. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michael Gillette. I'm an Associate Justice on the Oregon Supreme Court. I'm here to testify about Senate Joint Resolution 22, not in favor of it or against it, and indeed, I think in terms of how you vote on it ultimately, it's probably not even any of my business. It's a political choice for you to make, and that's why we hired all of you to do that. But I did want to bring to your attention some concerns that have arisen out of an initial run-through of the measure, which, and I took the liberty of asking Senator Decker to remain, too, because I just have some things I want to ask about on the assumption that the measure or some version of it will be adopted first, will first be submitted to the people and then adopted. And let me begin, if I may, by touching on the matter that was just discussed with Senator Corcoran, and that's the appointment of the fifth member. I have not seen the -1 amendments, and perhaps they take care of this, but as the original measure is worded, at least, this is at lines 24 and 25 on page 1 of the measure, it says, the four members by an affirmative vote of at least three shall appoint a fifth member, period. It doesn't say anything about the affiliation of the fifth member. And the way it's written now, the member could be a member of one of the two major parties. Senator Deckert assumes otherwise. Either the -1 amendments take the person out of the two parties or need to, if that's to be the way it's done. He just handed me a copy, so perhaps there it is. Okay. Going to change it. Fine. Well, that takes care of that. Never mind. Or at least perhaps it does. I've brought the matter to your attention in any event. Let me turn to the things that concern me a little more, and only a little more, but some. Senator Deckert said there's always the Supreme Court as a backstop. As you're probably aware, and I'm painfully aware since I've been excoriated by the members of at least one party with respect to our approval of the last reapportionment. The political apportionment process, no matter who does it, gores somebody's ox, or to be more accurate, gores a series of small oxes with the cumulative effect of goring one party's ox at the expense of another, even if it wasn't intended that way. As a backstop, it is no privilege to be placed in a position where we make the last call. So even if Senator Deckert feels encouraged, I can assure him that I know a lot of people who feel discouraged by the way we backstopped it last time, and I suppose that will always be the case. The measure proposes that if three members of the commission fail to approve and submit a redistricting plan by June 1st, that the Supreme Court, it says, and this is at page 2, lines 22 and 23, the Supreme Court shall adopt a plan by July 1st, period. How are we supposed to do that? That is to say, we are not informed at all with respect to what tools we will be handed, what information we will have available to us. Now, it may very well be that this can be worked out in practice quite well, and that's fine with me, but I do want to point out to you that as we do it now, the matter comes before us in the posture of a contested case in which lawyers on both sides refer to a record that's been created before the Secretary of State so that we have something to look to, and we make our own choices and our own decisions ultimately based on what has been collected by other people. There is no such guarantee in this process at all. And if you can imagine, would you wish in 30 days to just have somebody walk in and say, by the way, would you reapportion the state, please, and then walk out? We are not assured under this description of any kind of help. We'll have no staff. We'll simply be left to do something that a staffed organization could not accomplish in a far longer period of time. That's probably not a good idea unless you give us some help. Now, of course, you could give us some help, but the measure as it's presently worded in Section 10 says the Legislative Assembly shall appropriate monies to enable the Commission to carry out its duties, but it doesn't say anything about giving us any money to carry out ours. Help? We'd sort of like a little help with respect to that. And I have just one other matter of substance and two other matters that are much smaller. In section 9 of the measure, again on page 2, commencing at line 26, it says, and this is, of course, very sensible, the Legislative Assembly shall enact laws providing for the reconvening of a commission for the purpose of modifying a districting law adopted under this section. I don't know what the circumstances are that the sponsors have in mind with respect to why you would reconvene the commission, but what's really odd about it is it says reconvening of a commission. Whatever else you do, make it the commission, please, so that it's referring to the one that already exists. Otherwise, the choice of the indefinite article rather than the definite article is an affirmative statement that is to be a different commission than the other one. And I'm positive what's intended is just the opposite. So just as a matter of thinking my way through it, let me urge upon you a consideration of that. And also to note that in Section 10, there's a provision that says that the Legislative Assembly may enact laws setting the terms of office of members. And I'm not quite sure what that means, but if it means that one can continue to serve on this commission from decade to decade, I'm not sure if that's intended either, so I just thought you might want to think about it. And one last thing, at page 2, line 36, again, it says the Legislative Assembly shall enact laws implementing subsections 2 to 11. The laws shall set additional qualifications for members, additional standards to govern the commission, terms of office, etc. Let me urge you to change shall to may. At least that, given that list of things the Legislative Assembly is authorized to deal with, some of them are things you might want to leave alone. And I wouldn't want to say that you affirmatively had to set additional qualifications, for example. Why on earth do you have to? You could, and it's probably a good idea, but why do you have to? Mm-hmm. So the use of shall and may sort of is concerning on occasion. Senator Clarno, members of the committee, none of this should be understood as in any sense opposing the concept that's represented by Senator Deckard's proposal. That's not what I'm doing. And the way you want us to interact with the reapportionment process every 10 years is a choice for you to make. And if this would work better and would create a result which the public and the Legislative Assembly itself would feel was slightly more reliable and less politically affected, that's a choice for you to make. But at least I'd like to help avoid unintended problems with respect to the device that you select.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Corcoran.
Well, Justice Gillette, the one thing that occurs to me is that don't you run into some danger of separation of powers by having the judicial branch have an influence? The capacity of the judicial branch, if they were handed that role, they'd have an overwhelming capacity to manipulate the legislative process.
Senator Corcoran, members of the committee, you have no idea how often we wish to have exactly that.
No, I understand. especially in the budget, huh?
Especially with respect to the budget, and especially this year.
And would you limit the amount of bills that we produce?
Well, it's long been the position of some of us that for each bill passed, at least two should be repealed. But that might be good government, but it's not the practice. At all events, Senator Corcoran, members of the committee, because this is itself an amendment to the Constitution, the logical argument to be made is even though our Constitution specifically and separately says that there shall be a separation of powers, nonetheless, this is a qualification on that separation, which is made permissible by the fact it itself is an amendment to the Constitution. And that's the way the argument would run. I don't guarantee that the argument would succeed, but it has a certain cachet, I submit. Were that not true, it would be impossible to change in any sense the mix that exists between the three branches. And I don't know that the Constitution was intended to be quite that much of a straitjacket. So I would expect someone to make the argument, Senator Corcoran, but I don't think it's a dead certainty that it would be successful.
Okay.
Thank you. Further questions or discussions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Senator Deckard, did you want to come up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Ryan Deckard, the Justice brings up many, many good points. The Dash ones do accommodate many of the concerns, and unfortunately, our legislative process, they come out and parties don't get a chance to review them, but they do accommodate many of the concerns that that were raised.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And Justice Gillette, we do not see in any way your participation in this process as an interference. We're delighted to have your input. Thank you very much. Okay, we'll close the public hearing on SJR 22 and open a public hearing on SJR 33. And next I have signed up Michael Howden, Jordy Jones, and Tracy Johnson. I'll call three because there are three chairs here, and you are for the affirmative position on this bill. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Whoever's going to, let's see. Michael, I called your name first. If you were second to sign
sure.
up, if you'd like to introduce yourself for the record and start, we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Clarnell, members of the committee, my name is Michael Howden. I'm Executive Director of Stronger Families for Oregon. And my interest here in the bill is to make some general observations about the issue from a historical standpoint with legal decisions in the state, as well as regarding issues for stronger families. Our organization receives regularly phone calls from community members around the state who find these businesses opening up in their neighborhoods close by now, even closer than ever before, to residential and school areas. And we frequently hear from them about the influences of it specifically on young people in their community. And generally, those concerns are about how they're going to form ideas on marriage or stable relationships, how they view women, and perhaps an increase in other at-risk behaviors, which research has consistently demonstrated around the country is commonly associated with many of these businesses. Secondly, I just wanted to make an observation about Oregon's legal status. Right now, we hold a very unique position in our interpretation of free speech. An item that's coming around to you right now from committee administrator is a slight comparison, if you will, a very short and brief one, about one of the critical questions in our state, and that is the rendering of Article 1, Section 8 regarding the free exercise of expression. And what's very interesting to note in the three statewide go-rounds on whether or not Oregon was going to have an opportunity to regulate sexually oriented businesses and their activities, oftentimes it seems to resolve on the fact that Article 1, Section 8 cannot be interpreted any other way other than to not include, but to include obscenity as protective speech. However, you'll find in that handout we provided a number of comparisons of the same article or similar articles in other state constitutions around the state, and in each of those state situations they have not rendered the same interpretation that Oregon has dealt with or is faced with right now. I'd also like to encourage you to remember that in the year 2002, just before us, there were two court cases that came through the Oregon appeals court system. In both cases, challenging the precedent set in many of the decisions since 1985, 87, and so on. And in those decisions, one involving the community of Nyssa and another one involving Portland, the courts decided that there was an opportunity for regulation on this subject for communities. And without going into the rationale there, one of those, if not both of them, are in the appeals process right now. However, the rulings were very strong from the appeals courts, and the rationale, while being disagreed with by a number of people, we believe are very, very compelling on the part of the court. And we would agree with those court decisions that the ability for communities to provide some form of regulation is consistent with the intent of the Oregon Constitution, especially as it's compared to 49 other states in the nation. The industry, if you read through their literature, commonly recognizes Oregon as a state in a very unique position, and for purposes of their ability to grow and to place themselves, and we find that to be a very important consideration on this subject. And finally, I'd like to just offer the encouragement for you to remember that culturally, age restrictions on activities is a consistent issue in our culture. You find it obviously with driving privileges, with alcohol, with tobacco. Certainly if you look at the issue of military service, that's an interesting consideration. But if you compare that up against the issue of fitness, which is certainly the major requirement to defend your borders and to defend the very same Constitution, as well as the incredible training that goes along with that service, I don't see that as a straight across comparison with other age restrictions, especially if you find out and realize that those same military people do not have alcohol age restrictions lifted just because they are receiving all that training for that very patriotic but sadly very necessary service of defending your borders and the Constitution. So my purpose today is to encourage further consideration of this bill, and up against the backdrop of Oregon's unique legal situation, there were two court processes last year in the appeals court that we think bear impact on the consideration. Thank you for your attention to it.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Tracy Johnson, and thank you for listening to us today. I'm here because I'm a former dancer, and I know all of the impact that this has on us. If there is an expert, I'm an expert in the field. I danced for 6 years. It's not something that just came and went, and it has affected me directly, even through my marriage, which in my marriage I had met my husband in a dance club, and we were married for 14 years, so it's not like it was a fling, you know. When I quit dancing, his addiction to pornography did not quit, and even though it wasn't a in-your-face addiction to me, it was the demise of my marriage, which was extremely important to me. The demise of my marriage ended up being where my husband would medicate himself with pornography, and it ended up not just destroying my marriage, but my 22-year-old son's marriage, because my husband had sex with my son's wife. And sometimes people don't think that would have anything to do with anything. It does. It follows you all the way through. Follows me today. I'm a very healthy person right now, and I have been for years. But allowing children, I started when I was 21, allowing children, and I do say children, to go into these bars, and not even bars, juice bars, okay, table dances. Those are worse. I couldn't bring myself as a dancer to do a table dance. I tried it twice. I have a very good friend. We danced together. We came out of the life together. She's a TriMet bus driver. I mean, you know, we both have these great lives now. But she couldn't do it either. So now we have these young boys going in that can touch these girls, and they're doing it on their lunch hours at school. And they're going to be doing it. The girls have to be medicated when they dance. I know maybe 5% of the girls that dance are not medicated, maybe. And that's no exaggeration. I used to want to do double shifts, you know, make extra money. You dance for 8 hours, you walk home with $500. Hey, that's a great living. Not when you have to repair yourself in your life for what's afterwards. And it is so important to me that you guys look at the other side of it. My 22-year-old son, he was in the military. But it takes a lot to qualify. Just because he went in at 18 years old, he had to qualify to be in the military. So there is no age thing going on there. Why shouldn't he be able to go into a dance bar because he is 18? He would fight for his country. But he had to have physical and mental preparation. And all that preparation took about 6 months. And he told me, you know, Mom, boot camp was nothing. When we went to AIT, our technical training, oh, man, you want to talk about mind games. He said, that's when all the people fall out of the system in the military, is in AIT training. So if these young people that are fragile and they can't even make it through certain things like this, now they're taking on their whole family system. This is going to end up being in their family. They're taking it home. This is stuff that doesn't happen in the bedroom. Okay? It's a bunch of sex films. It's a bunch of fantasy. But it's not real life. And it changes how people really are. I battle right now. My stepson is dating a dancer. What a horrible cycle my children have. And it's awful. It's worse than drugs. It's worse than alcohol. Because drugs and alcohol, they seem to be where you have to go to certain places to get them. Now it's on the internet. I got off AOL because all the porno sites kept coming up on my computer. You know, when is it time that we start drawing a line? The age for alcohol is 21. Why can't we say, let's give these kids a few more years to mature a little bit more and make better decisions than I made? And if it injured me at 21 and it's injuring me at 39, then what is it going to do to them? And I thank you for hearing me.
Thanks for coming. Chair Clarno, Chair Brown, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jordy Jones. I live in Beaverton, Oregon. I'm a counselor who works primarily with women and the problems they face. I have seen the damage that pornography has done to women in particular, but also to young men who often get started with pornography at a very young age. I can add my own testimony to this discussion as well. I was exposed to pornography at the age of 12 until I was 15 years old. The exposure in my life greatly impacted my understanding of healthy sexuality and sexual relationships. It even affected the early part of my marriage, and I needed to seek help to heal from the damage it brought me. As a counselor, I have seen that the results of pornography in women's lives can be devastating. The young, impressionable women who get involved in the pornography industry so often have their self-esteem shattered and are ashamed beyond words. They carry many regrets for the rest of their lives. Oftentimes, young girls get involved with the pornography industry for financial reasons, to pay their way through college or to support themselves as single moms. Many are involved with drugs and alcohol and are stuck in a vicious cycle that spirals downward and often out of control. Unfortunately, even high school girls who are 18 years of age get exposed to the pornography industry because they think it's cool fun or because they like the attention. But in the end, their self-worth is destroyed. Some even become suicidal. It's shocking to realize that a young girl can still be in high school and be allowed to perform nude in these establishments. For example, I am personally aware of a situation where an 18-year-old girl was coaxed into being a dancer by her boyfriend for financial gain. She got into it but soon wanted out. She left it for a short time, but because of the money, she got back into it, moved to Las Vegas, and has cut off all contact with her family. Not only are young women impacted by pornography, but so are young men. The age at which males are exposed to pornography continues to drop. This is very damaging to their understanding of sexuality and their understanding of a woman's value. Pornography teaches men to view women as objects for their gratification and does not teach young men to respect young women with equality. The younger the person is that is exposed to pornography, the greater the long-term effects are on their lives, including a very negative impact in marriages and family. I believe due to the nature of this type of activity, we need to be responsible as a society to set proper age limits and to protect the impressionable minds of our young people. I would strongly suggest that the minimum age of viewing nudity and sexual activity should be 21 years of age. And as a matter of fact, I have 5 children of my own. My oldest daughter today just turned 18, and I cannot imagine her being involved in this type of activity at her age. So, thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
Thanks very much for being here today.
Thank you.
Next up, Christina Schertz, Francine Rudd, and Patricia Cobb. Thank you.
I'm sorry, please go ahead, who's ever. Oh, okay. Chair Kalarno, Chair Brown, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christina Schertz, and I live in Hillsborough, in Oregon. There are so many reasons why I feel that we should prohibit persons younger than 21 from participating in these types of establishments and getting involved in hardcore pornography. If we have agreed to protect those under 21 from the dangers of alcoholism and drunk driving by passing laws against their purchasing alcoholic beverages, why should we not consider protecting these same individuals from the destructive and addictive hazards of pornography? Currently, we are allowing the porn industry to legally attack our children as soon as they turn 18, while they are still in high school. What exactly are we exposing them to at this young age? What types of stereotypes are we encouraging? What kinds of effects will these images and stereotypes have on a young 18-year-old mind? There are a couple studies that I'm going to point to. These studies were done on male college students, and they were pre-screened to select out the hostile personalities. And this is the age group we're talking about here, the 18 to 21. They were more prone after they were exposed to pornography. They were more prone to accept commonly held conceptions like a woman really wants to be raped and yes means no. These men also denied the credibility of actual rape victims by viewing them as feeling less pain than they actually experienced and by holding them responsible for their own rapes. 57% of these males indicated some likelihood that they would commit a rape if guaranteed that they would not be caught. They also claimed that 30% of the women they know would enjoy being aggressively forced into sexual intercourse. After being exposed to pornography, for only 2 weeks, the subjects found violent pornography to be less and less violent and were increasingly less offended. And finally, the researchers found that themes of violence and domination in pornography had very strong effects on adolescent boys who are beginning to form stereotypes about human sexuality and violence. Do we really want to encourage this type of date rape mentality among our young people? Do we realize how susceptible these young minds are? Would I want my 15-year-old daughter to date an 18-year-old who regularly views hardcore pornography? Do I even want him sitting next to her in their English class? Why should we attempt to legislate pornography at all? Why not allow legal access by all ages to this type of material? Many porn proponents would cite a study done in Denmark by Brill Kaczynski. This study concluded that sex crimes drastically decreased after pornography was legalized in 1967. In the following statement, however, Paul Tanner addresses a few of the many flaws involving this study. I won't go through the whole thing. In Denmark, they promptly removed all age of consent laws with reference to sexual relations. The people who don't know or want to confuse point to Denmark and say, look how sex crimes have decreased. Well, of course, if sodomy, child seduction, rape, and other sexual molestations are no longer criminal offenses, the sex crime rates may go down to zero. Where there is no law, there is no criminal offense. What are the real facts? Assault rape in Denmark has increased 300%. Having spent a good part of my life in Europe, I strongly disagree with the often-mentioned argument that because of its deregulation, Europe has a quote-unquote healthy attitude towards sexuality. I have lived in Europe for most of my childhood and again as a young adult. I can say from my own experience that I do not generally feel safe in Europe. I have too often found myself in a position where I had to forcefully fend off unwanted sexual advances from strangers, even as a young child. I have never had such experiences here in the United States. I much prefer to live in a society where pornography is regulated and where we protect our young people from its demoralizing and destructive consequences. Let's give our young people a few more years to mature before we allow them the choice of falling prey to the destructive snares of hardcore pornography. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. I first want to apologize, Chair Clarno, for the misspell in your name. Chair Brown and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Patricia Cobb, and I reside in Aloha, Oregon. And there's many reasons I believe we should raise the age of our young adults that are allowed to enter establishments that contain pornography, especially violent pornography, hardcore pornography. And since my opinions are only that, I
had some statistics to offer you to support my feelings and my fears relating to the issue. According to an article by Dr. Victor Klein, psychotherapist, treated hundreds of sex addicts, and including children, he says that there are stages of addiction, repeated exposure, escalation, which they eventually become bored and want more hardcore, then desensitization occurs when they continue to view it, and what used to be shocking is now commonplace or normal to them, and they get the idea that everybody's doing it, so it's okay, and then fourth, they acting it out. So not all addicts get to this stage, but usually it is an end result. Tom Hedis, Citizen Magazine, reports that an editor at Stripper Magazine said that had mentioned that the internet, because of the internet, sex shops were going to be obsolete in a few years. And then more than a year later, he suggests that actually the opposite is true. And in fact, he suggests the internet has helped fuel demands for these sex shops. More people are getting addicted to the sex online, and then they're going out and looking for establishments where they can act out their desires. So Dr. Victor Klein, PhD, Utah, treated more than 350 sexually addicted men and teen boys, which is more the ages we're talking about, 18 to 20, says that the internet's one element, but it's very dangerous in this sex-saturated culture. And he said eventually they turn, after becoming addicted, they turn to prostitutes, strip clubs, peep shows, arcades, homosexual encounters, and more, he said. Which may be driving the growth of our SOBs in this area. And Burkhold says that based on report and some of his own studies, there's 2,600 sex clubs in the United States, and it's twice as much as there were just 12 years ago. So the National Crime Survey for 1973 and 77 conducted by the U.S. Bureau of Census revealed that the highest incident of rape occurs mostly among males ages 18 to 20, which again is the age limit that we're talking about. And in fact, all forms of violent crime and personal crime, rape, robbery, assault, and larceny from the person are committed more frequently by males 18 to 20 years old than in any other age group. So in conclusion, I'd like to say, if we know, number one, that according to Dr. Klein, that the stages are addiction, escalation, desensitization, and then finally acting out. And number two, we know that the internet is readily available to our young adults at their own homes. And according to Burkholt, that he believes it fuels the demand for the sex clubs. Number three, according to NCS, states that the highest incident of rape, in fact, all forms of violent and personal crime are committed more frequently by males 18 to 20 years old than any other group, why allow the additional temptation of these clubs and access to pornography to these age of our young youth? With alcohol being such a huge moneymaker in general, why do you suppose that SOBs forego selling it to allow the 18 to 20-year-olds in their clubs when it's such a big moneymaker for them? I believe their intention is to make the young adults future long-term customers and become addicts, and disregarding any negative effect that they have on the young adults and future leaders of our world to sustain their own pocketbooks. In my opinion, and obviously many others here today, it's as dangerous as alcohol, which does have an age limit of 21. So I think we should raise the limit also to 21.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Brown, Chair Klarna. My name is Francine Rudd, and I'm concerned that boys and girls who are still in high school can enter new dancing establishments. There are younger students in the high schools who look up to the older students and see their behavior, use their behavior as an example of how to behave themselves. And also there's a great peer influence, even for those who are 18 years old, just the peer influence itself can pressure other 18 and older students to attend these new dancing establishments. And according to research, there is evidence that best friends and siblings' sexual and other mildly deviant behaviors predicted these behaviors among young adolescents, and also that girls were, their sexual behavior was greatly influenced by their best male and female friends. And this is very much a problem because we have, in the United States, a very big problem with teen pregnancy. There are 870,000 pregnancies occur each year among 15 to 19-year-olds, and there's also a great problem with sexually transmitted diseases. We have about 3 million cases of sexually transmitted diseases that occur each year among children aged 10 to 19 years old. And allowing 18 to 20-year-olds into strip clubs, I believe, will not bring these statistics down. If anything, it will only encourage these statistics to increase because strip clubs promote irresponsible sexual behavior. Strip clubs do not promote responsible sexual behavior. The Oregon State Revised Statutes, there's criteria for human sexuality courses that are to be taught to students by educators, and one of the criteria is to promote abstinence for school-age youth and mutually monogamous relationships with an uninfected partner for adults is the safest and most responsible sexual behavior. And sexually transmitted diseases are supposed to also be taught as a serious possible hazard of sexual contact. And I believe that allowing 18-year-old, 19, 20-year-old students into these new dancing establishments does not promote responsible sexual behavior. And it, well, like I said before, the opposite of responsible sexual behavior is encouraged. There's a researcher, Edward Donnerstein, who's in the forefront of this particular subject, and he describes research that shows that generally any increase in heterosexual activity following exposure to pornography depended upon the presence of a consenting partner with whom the participant was already engaged in sexual activity, and that sexual activity will increase for up to 24 hours after exposure to actually what he calls this erotica. And erotica is a very mild form of pornography. And that's a problem because many 18 to 20-year-olds do have consenting partners, but their partners are not 18 years of age and older as well. According to statistics, less than half of all female sexual partners of 19-year-olds are 18 years old and older. More than half are actually younger than 18 years old. 4% are 13 to 14 years old, and 7% are 15 years old, and I have even more statistics here that show a large discrepancy in age between females and their partners. Research shows that partners of young women who first have sex during their teen years average about 3 years older than they are, and Oregon Revised Statutes states that a person who is 18 years of age or older commits a crime of contributing to the sexual delinquency of a minor if that person engages in sexual intercourse with that minor, whether it's a male or a female. And so I believe that if we allow 18, 19, and 20-year-olds into these new dancing establishments, if they have partners who are up to 3 years younger than themselves, these partners are minors, the new dancing establishments promote irresponsible sexual behavior, and what we have is a situation where these older males can not only get their younger partners pregnant and expose them to STDs, but we also have them breaking the law as well. And there are a few studies by Neil Malamuth. He states that males are considerably heavier consumers of what is typically considered pornographic than females. He cites a study that shows that pornography is an important primary or secondary source of information for males on topics such as masturbation, arousal, orgasm, and oral and anal intercourse. According to Malamuth, the use of sexual explicitness in media often conveys to the consumer that the acts portrayed may be used for entertainment and are therefore not particularly objectionable. He goes on to say that in another study, subjects who reported obtaining more information from explicit media also held attitudes more supportive of violence against women. And another researcher who also did research on males 18 to 20 years of age, he exposed half of the group to nonviolent pornography, the other half to no pornography, and the results of his study showed that there was a tendency for those who viewed the pornography to judge recreational and non-committed sexual encounters as more important than those not exposed to porn. And they summarized their study with, adoption of these values can be viewed as the direct result of absorbing porn's message that great sexual joy can be enjoyed by people who just met and will part shortly, never to meet again. And therefore, we can see that these are the kind of messages we do not want 18 to 20-year-olds to be receiving, especially since there is such a possibility that they will have partners who are younger than 18 years old. It's, sex is not a toy. It's something that should be treated with a great amount of responsibility. And in summary, strip clubs promote the acting out of irresponsible sexual behavior through the demonstration of nude dancing and the rental of sexually explicit and deviant videos. The state of Oregon allows students into these adult establishments while requiring educators to stress responsible sexual behavior to their students. Allowing students into strip clubs is counterproductive to sexual education efforts designed to promote responsible sexual practices. The recreational sexual attitudes developed by patrons 18 to 20 years of age who frequent strip clubs, whether they be high school students or not, can contribute to irresponsible sexual behavior among sexually active partners. This behavior, in turn, can lead to teen pregnancy and the acquisition of sexually transmitted diseases. Thank you.
Go ahead. Did you have another comment?
I did have one more comment.
Sure.
For listening. One thing I have observed, I've been involved kind of in protesting the one of these sexual-oriented businesses in our community, and we have observed minors entering this establishment. And I've talked to mothers who have said that their children underage have been into these places. And I've talked to mothers whose children say that their friends have been into these places. So I know that there's not a cop standing there making sure that all the IDs are checked. When our age is at 18, we know that the 13 through 17-year-olds are getting in because there's not a big difference in what they look like. And they're not always carded. If we can raise that, we're going to just push that whole group of underage patrons up, and which I think would just be very much worth it because we know these young kids are getting in as well. So that's all. Thanks.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? You did both this panel and the panel prior did a wonderful amount of research, and we thank you for all your hard work. So
thank you.
Next and last on the list, Dave Finanke, Ted Hughes, and Stephen Kafouri. Andrea, are you coming up as well? No. Okay. You won't kill each other up here, will you?
Uh-oh.
I don't think so.
Do you mind sitting next to Mr. Finanke?
No, I respect Mr. Finanke.
Okay. Thank you. I know you're not part of the same group.
He just wanted to see it himself in my comments ahead of time.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and other Madam Co-Chair. For the record, David Finanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon, testifying in opposition to SJR 33. For the benefit of the committee, Madam Chair, I put together a chart that lists the previous constitutional amendments that were placed before the voters on this general topic, beginning in 1994 with Measure 19, which attempted to amend Article 1, Section 8 to permit regulation of obscenity and child pornography. That measure was defeated by the voters 54% to 46%. In 1996, Ballot Measure 31, which was referred by the legislature, which attempted to amend Article 1, Section 8 to provide that obscenity could receive no greater protection under the Oregon Bill of Rights than under the federal Constitution. That was defeated by the voters 53% to 47%. And finally, in 2000 election, another referral from the legislature, Measure 87, which would have permitted regulation of the location of sexually oriented businesses through zoning by local governments, and that too was defeated 53% to 47%. The major point I want to make for the committee today is that this is a very complicated area to try to regulate. Even if the voters were to change their minds and amend or repeal Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Bill of Rights. This legislature and the people would not be writing on a blank slate. This measure before you today, as Senator Starr noted in his testimony, is very broad. It would permit the legislature, for example, to prohibit furnishing to anyone under the age of 18 any material which included any picture, photograph, drawing, sculpture, motion picture, film, or other visual representation or image of a person or portion of the human body that depicts nudity. Madam Chair, I was reading from current statute, ORS 167.065, which was ruled unconstitutional by the Oregon Court of Appeals back in the 1980s, based on the First Amendment to the federal Constitution. It, of course, would also be unconstitutional under the current interpretation of Article 1, Section 8. My point is that this has been tried before. These statutes have been written in ways that are overbroad, put government officials in the position of being censors, of deciding for families what they can read, see, and hear in the privacy of their own home or in a place that is open to consenting adults, and in some cases consenting minors in the case of movie theaters. We believe, and we believe the voters feel very strongly, that they do not want government officials deciding what we can read, see, and hear. Oregonians want to be able to make those decisions for themselves, and they have said so repeatedly at the ballot box whenever asked. And we strongly urge you to reject this proposed measure.
David, aside from the free speech issues that this proposal raises, can we regulate the age at which young people dance in juice bars?
Madam Co-Chair, juice bars is more difficult unless you prohibit minor entertainers, that is, people under the age. If you prohibit anyone under the age of 21 from going into an establishment, let me talk for a second about alcohol establishments.
You're going to have to leave. I'm sorry. I need to go testify on bills. So
I'll fill you in later, but okay. For the benefit of the record. In alcohol establishments where there is already regulation that prohibits anyone under the age of 21 from drinking alcohol, this state has been somewhat of two minds on that issue. Because on the one hand, we prohibit anyone under the age of 21 from drinking alcohol, but we don't prohibit, we don't require that anyone who works in an alcohol-serving establishment be age 21 or older. In fact, the restaurant and beverage industry has lobbied very hard to maintain their right or their ability to hire people between the ages of 18 and 20 to work in alcohol establishments. And but there is nothing in the Oregon Constitution, from our standpoint, that would prohibit the legislature from saying no one under the age of 21 can work in an establishment that sells alcohol. If you're going to have an age 21 requirement for imbibing alcoholic beverages, you certainly could have a limit of age 21 for someone to work in an establishment serving alcohol. The state doesn't. right now, although the Liquor Control Commission is trying to implement a rule that puts greater restrictions on the presence of some persons under the age of 21. In establishments that don't serve alcohol, I don't know what the basis would be for saying that no one under the age of 21 can work there. You certainly couldn't, consistent with the Constitution, say that, make a distinction between employees who engage in expression, who are performers, to treat them more harshly than other employees in an establishment. I think that would run afoul of the federal constitution as well as the Oregon constitution, because it would be based on the content of communication that's going on.
Thank you, David. Any questions? Not, Ted, you were signed up first, and then Steve.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I'm here today representing the Motion Picture Association of America. Motion Picture Association of America are the principal producers and distributors of movies and televisions. I'd like to say that I furnished you citations in their written comments, so I'm not going to refer to those at all. But I would like to say the intent of this bill or this resolution is very admirable.
I'm sorry, Ted. My assistant here, who's the only one left, shared with me that I didn't have you put your name on the record.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. Ted Hughes, representing the Motion Picture Association of America. I'm sorry. As I was saying, this resolution is very admirable, and perhaps our society would be much better off if we could embark on something like this constitutionally. But as David had just said, it's virtually impossible. This SJR is blatantly unconstitutional, as you will see by the material that I handed out. And the practical effect of it, besides that, is that should it go to a vote of the people, it would cost an awful lot of money, time, and effort on behalf of a whole bunch of coalition of folks to point this out to the voters. And should the voters vote yes, the coalition would then take it through the court system, and as they say, it's so blatantly unconstitutional, they would win. The consequences of that, of course, would be legal fees for the state, which would run between $500,000 and $1 million. And so that's the practical effect of putting something like this on the ballot. I think that's about all I'm going to say. My memo probably goes in great detail, more detail than you need. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes. Mr. Kafoury.
Madam Chair, my name is Stephen Kafoury. I'm here today on behalf of the AANR, which is the American Association for Nude Recreation, people who are commonly called nudists or naturalists. I have some. The AANR is a national organization, has 50,000 individual members and 253 clubs located across the United States. Madam Chair, unfortunately, there are some problems that the legislature doesn't really have the tools to solve. And you've heard some very heartfelt testimony today about some very serious problems. The problem is trying to resolve those difficulties, I think, is beyond the role of what this legislature's tools can accomplish. The AANR has worked across this country in many other states in attempts to restrict nudity, public nudity. Some of these are actually going against our members. There have been attempts to prohibit nude beaches and nude clubs. This probably has not attempted this. It's an overly broad, and it's probably attempt to control exploitative commercial activity. But the unintended consequences of this measure would be to prohibit our activities, which are quite harmless and, in fact, healthy. I've been to some of the clubs in here in the state and in California giving presentations on government relations activities. And what I've observed there is wholesome family activities. There's nothing prurient and nothing salacious about what goes on in these organizations. Some of these are privately owned, and some of them serve alcohol. And so if you try and say, well, let's make a distinction between commercial and non-commercial, or alcohol and non-serving alcohol, we've tried before looking at this. I don't think there's a way to do that. Nudism is a rapidly growing practice. Interesting, if you look in the booklet, there's a little notebook on giving advice to managers of public parks. And Oregon is mentioned there, for example, at the Rooster Rock State Park, where they have clothing optional beaches. And one of the things they're finding is that when state parks are opened up to clothing optional areas, popularity of parks goes up enormously, and the revenues of the state from fees, entrance fees, are appreciating. And there have not been records of problems in these when they're properly maintained. So we understand the concerns that led to this measure, but we think it would have deleterious effects on our members, our organizations, and the public at large. So we would hope that you'd vote no on the measure.
Thank you, Stephen. Any discussion? Questions?
Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen.
Close public hearing on SJR 33. Mr. Stembridge, anything further to come before the committee?
Madam Co-Chair, I think you have completed your agenda for the day.
Thank you, Mr. Stembridge. We are adjourned.